27th, 28th, 1997, and we're talking to John Schaefer. John, what year were you born?
October 6th, 1941.
And where were you born?
Evanston, Illinois.
And your parents were, what was the occupation of your parents at that time?
My father was a banker, and my mother, I guess, various careers in radio and in fashion. But at that point, I guess she was just a housewife. Yeah, when we left the North Shore of Chicago. When I was five, my parents moved to Vermont. And so I grew up in Vermont. I went to first grade through. I consider Vermont really home.
Mm-hmm. And your family's since?
Both my mother and father are dead now. My mother died last summer. My father died in 1984. So my sister, my only other sibling, is an older sister who has lived most recently in Bronxville, New York. But they go to Vermont in the summer now. And actually use my mother's family left in Vermont is a sister in her family who her kids are growing, and they're only there sort of off and on. So I really don't have, besides friends, I really don't have any relatives left in Vermont.
Do they have a religious affiliation?
Not really, no. Other than my father were churchgoers.
Where did you go to college?
Yale University.
Did you have any inkling before you went to college that you would ever go overseas?
Well, I always kind of wanted to see the world. And so I think I always knew that I would travel and do what capacity was never clear to me. I think it's interesting. I often think why, and I think a lot of it is the influence of parents who were, quite worldly in a certain sense and interested in the world and loved travel, particularly my mother. Writing novels or something.
We eat seafaring novels. Any Horatio Harmore
talks about, yeah. Talks about sailing around the world, I think probably gets you interested too. I read a lot as a kid.
What was your four-year degree in Yale?
English.
And how did you hear about IBS?
I went in the Peace Corps after Yale, and I went to Ethiopia. That was the satisfactory years in Ethiopia. I mean, it was very satisfying to me. I first heard about IBS. So I came back from the Peace Corps, and I was getting a master's at Harvard, Master of Arts in Teaching at Harvard. Then I got a job teaching in a secondary school in the Boston area, and sort of looking for something. I think it was part because the Vietnam War was such a tremendous event. I liked the teaching abroad, so I think I was looking around. I enjoyed the Peace Corps experience, so I was looking around for other programs. How I actually, where I actually, who told me about it or where I encountered it, but I heard about it somewhere. I think I was sort of looking around for programs. Did I know anyone? Okay. IBS.
How about what year was that?
That was 68, and I was teaching. I think once you got there, this situation proved so, in some ways, so complex and so assess one's notion about what help meant. But anyway, I think that was something that drew me there. Something about not wanting to miss the biggest historical event that I sent.
Oh, gosh. That was Oliver Stone's reason.
Was that Oliver Stone's reason?
Exactly in
yeah.
that way.
Well, he went to Yale, too, so
yeah,
I
so
don't
there
know.
You have
oh,
he's,
gosh.
He said this was
oh,
the biggest event of my generation. Mm. And I
think I did have that feeling, even though I hate his movies.
I'd like to get to the point you mentioned, which was that this idea of in mind.
Sure.
IBS seemed to be committed to the ideal that. You think about that?
I remember a couple of things. I remember Gene Stolzfus coming to talk to us, and this was, you see, after the Tet Offensive was uncertain, and Gene, I guess, had been there during Tet, I believe. Anyway, I think there was a sort of thunderclap And so Gene dove under the table, or started to anyway.
When you were
down at Harper's Ferry.
Oh, at Harper's Ferry.
He was addressing the group. Uh-huh. And so that was very dramatic. I mean, it sort of, what was just a thunderclap to me was obviously something different to him. And that was, and so it was kind of eye-opening. That and some, so one really realized you were moving into a war zone and that this was going to be a different experience from teaching English in Ethiopia. Remember that. I also remember, but Gene had good things to say, and I gave us a whole real dose of reality. Originally applied before the whole Tet Offensive, and the Tet Offensive changed everyone's thinking in IVS Washington about whether IVS would continue and so forth.
Because of the lack of security.
And whether or not they'd be putting new volunteers in insecure, you know, whether they'd be able to find positions, whether they'd be able to work effectively. Mm-hmm. And actually, I had originally they intended to send me to the University of Hue. And I had a master's degree at that point, some teaching experience. And so they were going to send me to the University of Hue to be one of the ones captured.
Right.
So I went to Da Nang, actually, for my first year. What was that?
Stop 1 second. Let me do a check here, and so we'll give it a little more try. And when I get down to San Francisco, I'll get another tape recorder.
Yeah.
Because we can't afford to have a
problem. Okay. Is it working?
It's working.
All right.
Okay.
Oh, I do remember another incident from Harper's Ferry. There was a person in the Vietnamese embassy named Nguyen Ngoc Bit.
Mm-hmm. Did you spell that?
Yeah, Nguyen space Ngoc space Bich. And he, I've met him since. He now, I'm not quite sure, he has a job in Washington, D.C. working. He's worked with bilingual education there and so forth. He's just a very well-educated person and speaks French and, I don't know, in things literary, he seems to know just about everything.
Mm-hmm.
A lot, very well-informed person. And he's taught courses in Vietnamese literature at George Mason.
Well, he's written a couple of books.
Yes.
You
know him well.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Well, he talked about Kim Văn Kiều, the verse narrative, Nguyễn Du's verse narrative written around 1800. He was very impressive. He was kind of slight, slender person, but talked a little about a different aspect of Vietnam, that I hadn't heard about and that one didn't hear about in the papers. So that made a lasting impression on me. It was an interesting talk. It sounded like an interesting literary work. And so I remember that. But remember about old Harper's Ferry. Besides the congenial proprietor. What was his name? I forget his name.
Yes. Someone did remember it, by the way.
Oh, did you? Oh,
most people didn't say it.
Yeah. But it was a very nice atmosphere down there.
And you were going to be an education.
Yes, yes.
So what was your first impression when you arrived in Saigon? So when was that? Was it?
Let's see. We went to Hawaii for a couple of weeks for language training.
Ah.
Really useful. It was fun. There, my strongest memory of this absolutely beautiful Amerasian teacher. Father was French, and I remember all my Vietnamese at that time.
Do you remember
it was easy to concentrate on the Vietnamese, but
remember her name?
I think Renee. I think her name was Renee.
I'll look after her when I go back.
Yeah, I'll look after her.
Yes.
She's probably getting on in years now, as we all are.
Yes, but I'm sure. But
I bet she's still striking.
Whether she's striking or not, this is a new wrinkle, actually, because I haven't interviewed anyone yet who was recalling the language training took place.
We were only there for about a week or 10 days.
Ah.
And it was something they did for USAID, I think, more than IVS. And this was the experiment. It was moderately useful. It was certainly wonderful to be in Hawaii. And most of our training, though, did occur, actually, for us in Phan Chu Trinh High School in Da Nang. And by IVS to teach three or four of us. It was Jerry Underdahl was in that group, mm-hmm. the guy who's in Palo Alto, and I was in that group. And I think Ron Gould, for some reason, he was in that group. group, because I don't think he... Yeah, we got taught in Fanchichen High School in Da Nang. That was, yeah, so the training, there wasn't really too much that happened in Hawaii. You asked about first impressions.
Yes, this is for the first impression chapter.
First impression chapter, yeah, right, absolutely. Well, gosh, it's hard to recreate that first. I just remember kind of the tremendous amount of military traffic in Saigon, the fact that everyone was dressed in so many people dressed in uniforms, and the traffic going by, and the garbage often on the sides of the streets, and a city obviously just, obviously very, very different from what it had been, and very much affected by the war and the military traffic. And remember the IVS house there? But I got, in talking to some of the older volunteers, and some of this may be clouded by talking to Don Lu here, but one got the sense of, gee, what a lovely place this was a few years before the war, you know. And that the war, there weren't shells going off. There weren't, at that point, even rocket attacks that I remember. But just, it was very clear this was kind of the rear guard of the war. And but then, of course, these beautiful Vietnamese women in Ao Yai's picking their way along the dirty streets and looking beautiful and not getting, hovering above the sort of filth of the war in many ways. I'm talking to some of the volunteers and getting a feel for what we'd be involved in. But I remember playing basketball. They had at that point, before the veterans started claiming land, I don't know if you've been told about that. I remember that toward the end, the veterans movement, I forget what was that name in Vietnamese, I guess I forgot, reclaim the land movement by the veterans and other groups. And I think veterans would start, they were starting sort of claiming that land. We were on the old agricultural station where the IVS office was, terribly, but we did have a half court basketball. So I remember playing with Mark Litt, and then he became, he became a lawyer, and is still a lawyer in Washington. He was with us on the staff then, a very bright guy, and knew everybody. I mean, he was a tremendous source. He was tuned in to sort of various communities, and sort of to my first impressions. Then I sprained my ankle playing basketball.
You sprained
so here I was. So I remember going to Da Nang afterward. We were only there a short time, and going to Da Nang to study Vietnamese, moves on crutches, and the sweat would just be pouring down. I was staying with this Vietnamese family who, he was a French teacher at Fanchichen, and the idea was to learn languages, you'd all be with a family there in the Da Nang area, so such. And they gave me these more sort of stainless steel chopsticks there for the guest, but they were so slippery. I was still learning chopsticks. So finally, they got me an old wooden pair that I could hang on to a little better, but that was so sweaty. It was good. We did learn Vietnamese. You know, it was a pretty good chance to learn some Vietnamese there that summer.
And then you went?
Well, I stayed right in Da Nang, because that's where I was, teaching at Fanchichen High School. And, yeah, that was hard in that Da Nang then was, there were so many, Americans were no longer sort of free to roam like they once was. I mean, they had so many problems, they sort of were more or less confined to base, more or less, but there were a lot of civilian contractors working for Pacific Architects and Engineers. I mean, it was just the American effort, it was ringed with Marine bases and Army bases, and very unlike Hue in that regard, where Hue, they had made a purposeful decision to not put an American base right in the city. It was at Fubai, a V compound in a way, but Da Nang was hard. And the American influence was so dominant, and, well, you know, had some people had pleasant experiences with Americans, many had unpleasant, and even if the experience was more or less neutral, there was just the fact of the overwhelming presence. So the atmosphere at the high school was a little tense toward Americans. I mean, it's not like in your way there, I'd say. And it did slowly, but it was a hard situation to come into. The students weren't, they wanted to learn English, though. And also there's the fact of large classes. You need a 50. Well, I would say it was a challenging teaching.
Big classes, and people on edge because
some anti-American students.
It's overwhelming.
Right. Yeah. Luckily, I'd had some teaching experience to quote, but I think in my mind, I was comparing it to the Peace Corps. It's interesting. The Peace Corps in the early 60s was a different operation. The Peace Corps was less politically aware of their role. Mm-hmm. And I think people in the developing world were also less aware of the political results of sort of Peace Corps activity. And the two together made for a somewhat more innocent time. What happened in Vietnam with IVS is that, and it's the reason, and IVSers became aware of it, is that the line between development work and helping and political pacification was blurred greatly. And it made it, maybe we were doing political pacification in Ethiopia too in the Peace Corps. And we probably were to a certain extent. But we were more naive about it and innocent about it. And the Ethiopians were more innocent about it. And so it made for a different atmosphere. In Vietnam, it was difficult. I mean, units were giving shots and building a school or something, and as part of their sort of big action wing of their, and so, you know, where did their line end and where did our work begin? And it was all a little blurry, and it made us all feel a little uncomfortable, at least a lot of us. Probably should have been more aware, and of course we had people talking to us at very, I think what happens when you're young and you want the experiences that you don't want to be too critical, or asked, if you've made up your mind you want to go, you don't want to be too critical about the possible role you may be performing there. I mean, you want to go and see for yourself, and partly it's just that. You want to trust your own impressions and your own judgments. And even though the information's probably there, I don't know how responsive you are to it. I think it's the reason the Peace Corps has gone to in-country training, kind of, you know. I mean, you sort of have to go there and then learn and then form your own impressions. Advance information is helpful to a certain extent, but I'm not sure it really does the trick. Wasn't quite prepared either for the fact that how difficult it was to carve out a separate niche for yourself within the American mission. The American presence was more overwhelming than I should have. 500,000 American troops, I mean, in a small country, I should have realized that. But I guess you sort of have to see the American trucks, the big Americans everywhere in Saigon. You sort of have to experience that before it really dawns on you. Although in Hue, where I later went after Da Nang, and then when your Vietnamese gets a little better and people begin to accept you, then you can carve out a separate. You can make your own friends. And I think in Hue, of course, this was after IBS, and my last 2 years there were with the Fulbright program, there were some people who sort of treated me differently from just a member of the great American octopus, you know, that was the tentacles of which were everywhere. Other people probably thought I was a CIA agent, you know.
Well, I've been telling the story to several times. Speaking of your story, yeah. He was saying that we were walking along, and I told him about this project, and he said, oh, then you would know.
And I said, what? He says, well, I've always wondered, were they CIA?
Louisiana himself.
Louisiana didn't know.
Yeah. See, he didn't, yeah. And if he was suspicious, being so sophisticated and in touch, then you can imagine how other people
were. Well, he wasn't suspicious.
Yeah.
He just never knew, finally, whether at what some level, you know, whether or not it was connected.
Right.
I mean, that was the impression I got, because he is an extraordinarily savvy person.
Oh, yes.
But I think what he meant was, you know, well, for example, like this, the USAID funded it.
Mm-hmm.
He might not, for example, be aware whether that USAID influence had another connotation. Or
absolutely, and he has reason to be suspicious.
Yeah. But again, he wasn't suspicious. He was just
suspicious.
Curious. And the other thing, of course, he was in, you know, his visits to Vietnam were very short. He'd come back and report, so he wasn't that tuned into what was happening as much as others. I'm sure the Saigon government probably had all asked.
Sure.
If they want us to do this, we'll support the program and just let it do their thing. Yeah.
Well, when so many IBS volunteers began to work as stringers for newspapers and began to show them things that the government, then they began to realize maybe they weren't, at least a large group of them were not CIA agents.
Or they certainly, unless the America's being very subtle, like the Russians in Afghanistan, you know, we come in and kill our own guy, you know, like that. And so there's a great Bloomsbury cartoon, by the way, about that. I'll just have to show you. It doesn't make any sense. It's a CIA plot. And everyone laughs. He says, but it's true. They say, yes, but we still have to laugh because it's so funny. Yeah. But anyway, the one of the questions I've asked everybody is, what was your day
school as opposed to the university?
Right.
Yeah, my first year. Formed friendships with Mr. Vian, who was the, and his brother, who, his brother didn't teach at Fanchon Trinh, taught at another high school, but he was a member of that family that I lived with, and a good friendship with him, and he took us, for example, which was Hoi An, which is that lovely village on the coast south of Denver area, but it was secure enough for us to go there one day. So I had friendships with him, and of course the English teacher, Mr. Key, who taught us English in the summer to the IBS volunteers, that became a friendship that continued. He was just, he's English. We made friends. I lived in what was the Da Nang IBS house with first year, or the first part of the time there, with Tim Jones, he was the I-Corps IBS leader. He was very good in Vietnamese there too. And so I guess it was just the boot camp, and Phil Yang were working in the Shoeshine Project that time.
Tell me about the Shoeshine Project.
Yeah. The project was to, and Phil and Bill Camp. Bill Camp was a character, really. He was a veteran, Army veteran, who'd come back. he was a tough guy, and had kind of a soldier's view of Vietnam in some ways. Anyway, he and Phil worked in the Shoeshine, and it was to give Shoeshine abandoned youth a chance, a place to stay, and to a home and some sort of place where they could lead a kind of ordered life. But it wasn't ever too clear to me, quite frankly, beyond that, what the goals of the program were and whether it was achieving them. Maybe that's enough of a goal.
Was it a formal IBS project, or was it just something they did in spare time, like holding English classes?
See, then there was Dick Hughes, who wasn't in IBS, but also had a similar project in Saigon, and got a lot of publicity, and he's still, Dick Hughes is an amazing guy who's devoted, involved, and helping some people who were involved in it. I know David gave some support for people who have had trouble with the government, I guess because of their involvement with some of Dick Hughes's. The two were not really connected. This was IBS's Shoeshine Project.
It was IBS's
Shoeshine. But Dick Hughes would come up and visit it, and there was some relationship there.
Yeah.
And Phil and Bill knew Dick Hughes, and they would talk. But I don't believe there was any kind of, there wasn't any sort of real administrative link there that I knew about.
Because sometimes people ask me, and they seem to confabulate
the two
yes.
projects
yes.
and things like that.
That's my. But you know, it's funny. They would come up and see us at the IBS house, although they didn't live there, and so I didn't feel. You know, I don't really feel. I knew. It's funny. I should have gotten. In some ways, it would have been a project I should have gotten more interested in. And learned more of the details of, but from what I did learn, I never felt I got too clear a sense of its goals beyond sort of providing a place to stay. Mm-hmm. But I think it didn't seem to me, it seemed to be awfully hard for an American speaking rudimentary Vietnamese to act in any sort of father figure capacity mm-hmm. to Vietnamese youth. Mm-hmm. And it seemed to me, in some ways, I'll be perfectly honest, a kind of misconstrued program. But you could raise those questions about, I think, at that point.
Okay. In what sense? Roll with that.
Well, it's, and I think it's the kind of, that kind of reflection that did the people resigning and Don earlier, that it occurred earlier, and I think it's kind of, are you part of the problem or part of the solution? And if, that was a kind of common phrase of the 60s, but in some ways it had some validity. In other words, would you be more, if you feel the way you feel, maybe you'd be more useful going back and working some sort of political anti-war activities in the United States. I mean, not everyone was, I don't mean that everyone in IBS had the same kind of anti-war views, but I would say that everyone felt very concerned about the Vietnamese and wanted to do what was best for them. I think you could say that universally. People were concerned and wanted to help out. And, you know, Han and John Summer in their book talk about the case of the IBS refugee overhearing a radio transmission or something. You know, we can sort of make more refugees because we got an IBS volunteer there who will take care of them. You know, you sort of get drawn into these situations. I don't mean that there's any clear-cut answer. And a lot of the questions are the questions about sort of person-to-person volunteer efforts. And, you know, if you help one small person, maybe that's enough and that's significant. And if, you know, small acts of kindness on an individual basis, don't need any larger justification, even if, you know, the world's going to hell in a handbasket all around you. But I suppose another view would be if maybe your energies would be helped more by going back to the United States and doing something, you know, involved in some sort of political activity there. Now, I mean, I'm not saying that I took that route. I had the chance to take that route, and I stayed my 2 years. What happens is you sort of get drawn in for personal reasons. And, I found Vietnam fascinating, not so much the war, but just the people and the culture, and I got interested in the language. And I started to read, I started just reading novels just to learn Vietnamese, and I got interest, kind of hooked on Vietnamese literature, and it's still an interest. I still write articles and try to publish them, so... But I think what the questions about the Shoeshine Project could be writ a little larger, I think, and maybe applied to the whole program. I think most people had a certain ambivalent feeling about their role.
Well, there's one thing. Maybe you can help me clarify something or change the tape. But go there, and then you become involved. Mm-hmm. You become a lot. They were looking at... a country, the people they saw were not trying to bring down the government. They seemed to be perfectly satisfied with the status quo. That when you would go out into the countryside, even a lot of the countryside, people weren't hissing at IBS community development people. Sure, there were guerrillas in the jungle, and sure, there were villagers who knew that tonight they might come back in, but they didn't say anything to the IBSers. You could get this feeling that you were in a good space. This wasn't the worst government in the world. Communism isn't the best alternative philosophy. But then there are IVSers who go further and become supporters of the war because the only way, through USAID, that is, joining USAID and going, well, this is the best way we can help these people, is by committing ourselves to helping them and keeping them, quote, free, unquote. But then there's another group, and they're younger, they come out with a different view for the most part, who immediately see that the war is destroying a lot of the Vietnam that they actually love. And they're willing to bring, if it means that the country will fall to the communists, it would be better, and this is the, I'd like you to think about that, it would be better that that would happen than it can continue to be destroyed piecemeal and wholly by the war that the Americans are waging. Does that sound like the kinds of arguments that were going on at the time, and how did you look at them?
Going on at the time, yes, I think those arguments were going on at the time.